It's a smaller gavel.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm going to open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3367 and ask Representative Olson and his panel to come on up. Go ahead and just break the plastic clips. And
go
ahead. I can wait
for the next one if we just want
to. Okay. Yeah, come on up.
Okay.
Okay, tell us about the...
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Andy Olson. I'm a state representative from Albany. And I'm just share with you House Bill 3367 on this issue. This bill stemmed from a project in Benton County where the county proposed constructing a bike path through miles of prime farmland. While the county ended up going through the land use process, the proposed bike path highlighted a dispute in current law as to whether land use permits were required for trails through lands zoned for farm use. Given the significant interest in rails to trails projects, this bill is necessary to clarify that these recreational trail projects should go through the local land use process and ensure that impacted landowners have a forum to raise potential impacts and conflicts associated with these projects. House Bill 3367 would require recreational trails to go through the conditional land use permitting process. Under current law, it is not clear whether recreational trails are permitted outright in farm use zones or whether they must have a permit from the local governing body before they are constructed. House Bill 3367 clarifies that recreational trails require a land use permit. The permit process gives neighboring landowners a forum to provide evidence on impacts to their farming operations from the project and requires the local governing body to make a finding that the project will not significantly increase the cost of farming practices or force a significant change in farming practices in the area impacted by the project. And I encourage your support. I do have a panel here with me that are, they are good.
Whoever would like to start.
I'll jump right in. My name is Tina Galloway, and I'm with Stalbush Island Farms. We are here in support of House Bill 3367, and we thank you for this opportunity to share with you. Stalbush Island Farms is a family-owned farm and food processing company based in Corvallis, Oregon. We are third-party certified for sustainability, organic agriculture, as well as food safety. Bill and Carla Chambers started the company in 1985 with two employees and two crops. And in less than 30 years, we now farm nearly 5,000 acres and have nearly 600 local jobs. So our farm is a great part of the local economy. And issues like this that affect us and our ability to grow are of great interest, and that's why we're here today. House Bill 3367 clarifies that a recreational path in exclusive farm use land is not an outright permitted use, but that it actually requires a conditional use permit. The clarification is important because right now a potential loophole exists. The loophole exists because of the ambiguity between OAR 660-012-0065 and ORS 215213, where the former indicates the recreational path could be approved without any review considerations. House Bill 3367 addresses this by stating clearly that a recreational path, any recreational path on EFU lands, would require a conditional use permit and that process. In Benton County, we recently battled this situation and addressed this ambiguity. A recreational trail was proposed between Albany and Corvallis, and it was going to go right through some of the highest value farmland you'll find in the country. Because of the ambiguity that I just mentioned, the county wasn't at first sure whether or not to require a conditional use permit for this path. Fortunately, the staff, the planning staff, chose to be conservative and require this permit. So the decision, that decision allowed public participation and a complete review by the Benton County Planning Commission. 100% of the farmers that would have been impacted by this trail opposed the trail and spent an incredible amount of time, money, and energy educating the Planning Commission and the public on how this would impact our farms and our farming practices. After much discussion, the Planning Commission voted unanimously to deny the conditional use permit. They determined that the path did not meet any of the land use criteria. So in this case, the requirement of a permit saved valuable and irreplaceable farmland. If Benton County planning staff had not required the conditional use permit, this path could have been pursued and built without any kind of due process or that opportunity to educate on the impact of farming practices. The county intended to use eminent domain to gain access to our farmland, and they showed a complete disregard for our farmland and our practices and the impacts on our businesses. If the permit had not been required, a trail could have been pursued and built that was clearly not in the best interest of the county or the community. This lack of regulatory clarity and control, it allows for the potential for corruption. And so it's not responsible for the state of Oregon to leave this loophole open. In the case of the Benton County bike path, public process stopped the implementation of a bad idea before it was too late. The same process improvement needs to be made at all levels. We need to be focusing on due process and ethics at all levels. For example, in this case, $2 million of Connect Oregon funds had been awarded to this bike path in spite of extreme flaws and inaccuracies in their application. If that process had a better review process and had it been enforced, a lot of time and money would have been saved, and those dollars could have been allocated earlier to projects that deserved them. Stalbush Island Farms does not oppose biking or multi-use paths. We support improvements that strengthen the health and wellness of Oregon communities and the protection of valuable and irreplaceable farmland. We also support the continuing focus on ethics in government. House Bill 3367 addresses all of these needs, and we strongly urge you to support the passing of this bill. Thanks for your time today.
Go ahead.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, and I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. First of all, we'd like to thank Representative Olson and all of the others that helped support this bill. We think it's a really important issue, and we're really happy that the committee is hearing it. As you've heard from others, and I won't repeat, House Bill 3367 closes a significant loophole in existing law. Right now, at the local planning level, there's significant confusion about whether a conditional use permit is required for these types of recreational trails. And backing out from the specific issue in Benton County a little bit, this is an important issue moving forward because we're seeing a significant increase in proposed rails-to-trails projects. And those are projects that will turn existing right-of-ways, sometimes that haven't been used for years, into multiple-use paths. And if it is not clear through that process that these projects require conditional use approval, it effectively shuts farmers out of the process and doesn't give them any forum to raise potential issues, impacts to their operations, suggestions about mitigation actions that could be undertaken to minimize those impacts. That entire process is foreclosed if we don't close this loophole and make it clear to local planning commissions that when you site a bike path, a recreational trail, you must go through the conditional use process and you must have that level of review in that forum for folks to come forward with any impacts that they think the project may have on their operations. This is particularly important in the rails to trails context because changing the use, even if it's an existing railroad or some other form of right-of-way, can have significant impacts on the operations. And areas devoted to agriculture farming uses include irrigation, tilling, spraying, and harvesting crops. Putting a recreational trail through the middle of these operations creates a host of concerns and issues that are not present with other types of use. These recreational trails are typically viewed as places of solitude set apart from activities that require more intensive land management. And that just creates an inherent risk of conflict and trespass onto private farmland. So this bill is designed to ensure that all new recreational trails on EFU, regardless of the previous use of the land, are subject to the conditional use process so that farmers can raise any concerns about conflicts and compatibility before the trail is constructed. So thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony, and I am, of course, happy to take questions.
Go right ahead, sir.
Thank you. My name is Stan Snyder. My wife and I own a farm between Corvallis and Albany along Highway 20, and we were directly impacted by the proposed bike path that Benton County proposes. And it was a trying ordeal for us, I must say, and we were happy to see it come to the conclusion it came to. So we are very much in favor of House Bill 3367 and urge you to pass this bill. This bike path that was proposed would have been 20 feet wide, 16 feet of which would have been paved with 3 feet of gravel shoulders on each side, and it would have consumed quite a few acres between the two towns, as you might suspect. But more importantly than that was the fact that it would have really, very seriously, negatively impacted farming practices between the two towns. Our only access to our fields on the north side of the highway would have been part of the bike path. We have two access points, one for long vehicles, like our semi-trucks that take the grass bales out of the fields, and another wider path that takes a more circuitous route that the semis can't use, but is wide enough for combines, swathers, and other larger implements of that sort. And so both of these entrances into our north fields were absolutely essential. It could have been a disaster to try to mix in bikes with some of these vehicles going through this area. And so they never did come to any sort of conclusion where this would, or satisfactory conclusion for use of these fields with all the bikes going through there as they wished. Anyway, a number of other things concern us tremendously. Chemicals used for spraying crops, fertilizers. We all use honeybees for fertilizer, pollinizing crops, dust, pollens. All these things are not really very compatible with bikers going through there, and you can imagine that as well. I would urge you to pass House Bill 3367, requiring conditional land use permitting process for all such projects in the future. Thank you very much.
Right. Any questions for this group?
Just one.
Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marianne, can you just describe briefly, is the conditional use process, in your opinion, a burdensome process to go through, or is it overly burdensome, or is it a good process for this kind of proposed use?
Thank you, Chair Clown, Vice Chair Helm. I think the conditional use process is incredibly appropriate for this type of use. The conditional use process does not predetermine any outcome. It simply, basically is a process for the county to evaluate whether or not certain conditions are met for the project, and of importance to farmers, one of those conditions is impacts on neighboring properties. And I think it's very easy to imagine a situation in which there's, you know, a trail adjacent to a road and the impacts aren't very significant and people aren't going to come forward with much and the process is going to go through just fine. But like in the case of Benton County, it was just a plan that wasn't very well thought out and that was going to have significant impacts. And this provides that forum to kind of catch those projects before they go forward and have those impacts. But it really is just a forum for that process to occur, and it certainly has no predetermined outcome, and it's not burdensome in the case of most projects. And I think in this one, it's certainly not burdensome. It just, there was a lot of impacted owners and they came forward and you hear from them. And that's exactly how the process is supposed to work. When something has significant impacts, you hear about them, and when it doesn't, you don't, and it can go forward just fine. So thank you.
Any other questions? Did you say that I heard the term either gray area or something used, but is it the we have some testimony coming up later that I'm reading right now that characterizes the establishment of recreational trails as an outright allowable use. Is that your view as well?
So under, this is a bit of a technical answer, but under 215.283, sub 1, sub I, reconstruction or modification of public roads or highways is permitted outright, whereas 215.283, sub 3, applies to other types of transportation development and requires that local land use approval already. Through rulemaking, DLCD authorized bikeways, footpaths, recreational trails not otherwise allowed as a modification or part of an existing road to proceed without going through the goal exception process. And I think that that OAR, DLCD enacting that rule, is what created the confusion among some local planners as to, okay, if you are authorizing these without a goal exception, are they then part of the outright permitted use under Chapter 215? So to me, this is just kind of, and I don't think that that's what DLCD intended. I think DLCD probably still did intend for that local land use approval to proceed, but there has just been, we've heard confusion, and in the case of Benton County, I think there was some initial confusion at the local level as to what that OAR meant and whether or not that required that level of local land use approval. So we just want to make it really clear on the record. And one of the important pieces for this is that this may be part of a modification of an existing road in the case of like these rails to trails projects. If there is some sort of, you know, road that has not been used for a long time, we do think in the context of a recreational trail, it's important to have the conditional use permitting process, even if you are, you know, changing the use of an existing right-of-way, because in the case of these rails to trails projects, the change in use is so significant. Oftentimes those right-of-ways have been abandoned and not used for a number of years. So we do want to make it clear that those kinds of new developments do require conditional land use approval.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I've got Steve McCoy, Jim Johnson, and Cindy Robert. Steve, I got you up first.
Great. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We work with Oregonians to support livable urban and rural communities, protect family farms and forests, and provide transportation and housing choice. So here we're talking about protecting family farms and transportation choice. This bill merely clarifies that it's a conditional use, that these recreational trails across farmland is a conditional use. It does not ban them or make them onerously difficult to approve. It just makes sure that there will be a reasoned discussion about the trade-offs. So we support HB 3667. Thank you.
And Jim?
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the land use specialist with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. First, right off the top, I'd like to say that the department is neutral on this bill, but we'd like to point out several issues that we've presented themselves as we've dealt with this issue over the years. Like everybody else has said, but I'd like to reiterate that House Bill 3367, in effect, establishes these types of trails as a conditional use, as a sub 2 use in the exclusive farm use zone, so it would be subject to local review process. That is not unlike the process used currently for most non-farm uses in the exclusive farm use zone, whether in the sub 1 category or the sub 2 category of the land use process. So this is nothing new. There's a lot of process history to this. There's a lot of interpretation related to how 215.296 is reviewed, and I think that's the real important element of this. This is in terms of agriculture's position, and that is that these types of facilities look at the impacts to agriculture. As a permitted use, there's no review at all. Marianne Nash talked about the difference between the administrative rule and the statute. If you look at the statute, it really talks about applying 215.296, which are the compatibility standards for non-farm uses with agriculture. But the administrative rule is kind of it doesn't hit it out of the park, so to speak. It basically lists the use in the administrative rule as a use that may be allowed, but it doesn't reference back to 215-296. So a lot of counties are not even looking at the statute. They're just looking at the administrative rule, and depending on which county you're in, they're basically arguing that it's a permitted use outright by LCDC administrative rule. Recreational trails, other trails, and the like are linear facilities in an exclusive farm use zone. Some of the most problematic facilities that we deal with over the years in terms of compatibility with agriculture are linear facilities. It's a long edge, so you're dealing with a lot of properties as opposed to a very limited amount of properties with just a spot type of land use. A long edge also invites multiple jurisdictional use. So a trail could be going through 2, 3, 4, 5 or more different counties. If one county says it's a conditional use permit and another county says it's not, you're going to be going different standards from segment to segment. These are the type of facilities that there really needs to be consistency in the law in terms of how they're reviewed for the entire length of the project. I'm not going to go into... that this is a new non-farm use, because it's really not a new non-farm use. It's a matter of interpretation how it's approved either outright or as a non-farm use. And so I would argue this is not a new non-farm use being put onto the list of farm uses. It's really just clarifying how it's reviewed. I think it's important to understand this is, we've heard an awful lot about the Benton County Trail, but I'm aware of at least trails being proposed in 4 or 5 other counties, so this gets to the multiple jurisdiction issue. There's been a trail proposed in Tillamook and Washington counties. There's been a trail proposed in Yamhill County, in Wasco County, and in Wallowa and Union County. So this is an issue that's very timely in terms of how the legislature may wish to address this. And finally, this is one of the many non-farm uses in the exclusive farm use zone that really gets to just one of the pressures facing agriculture in terms of non-farm uses. And I understand that Senate Bill 204, well, as it's being worked on currently, is proposing to, again, do a cumulative impacts work group as opposed to deal with the issue of non-farm uses in a farm zone, not just trails, but other non-farm uses. And so this is a good example of the bigger issue of non-farm uses and cumulative impacts on the farm zone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here on behalf of the 1,000 members of the Oregon Recreation and Park Association. So perhaps I've come too late to the conversation and I'm a little confused, but a couple pieces of concern from our standpoint, and maybe, again, we need some clarification. But from our standpoint, about hundreds of miles of trails have been developed through this process. And the process does not necessarily include the county or multiple jurisdictions like Mr. Johnson refers to as being problematic. It's between the Parks Division, the trail maker, and the farmer, the landowner. And so I'm confused what the issue is. Why would we want to bring a county or city into something that a landowner can already negotiate directly? That's my big confusion point. As to the multi-jurisdictional piece, the Central Oregon communities of Bend, Prineville, Redmond, and Sisters are currently working on a collaborative approach. And if this kind of conditional permitting goes into effect, each one of those areas is going to have to go through a different jurisdictional review. This process has worked for years. Yes, there was an anomaly in the Albany area, and it did not work out. But for the most part, the system has worked, and we encourage you to look at ways of making sure that other problems don't occur without going back and changing and adding more red tape to a process that has been beneficial to all Oregonians.
Questions? Jim, you might know the answer to this. If there were multi-jurisdictions, wouldn't one issue a condition? Wouldn't just the county issue a conditional use permit, or how does that work?
Chair Clem, the jurisdictions that would issue the permits depend on where the jurisdiction of where the trail is going. So if it goes through the city of Albany, Benton County, Linn County, and then the city of Albany, you've got 4 different jurisdictions there. Some may require permits, some may not, depending on what their code requires. A city zoning code may or may not require a land use permit. A county zoning code, depending on the zone, may or may not. So it's going to be pertinent to whatever the jurisdiction is and what their land use code says.
But theoretically, you would get multiple conditional use permits for each section of the trail that's within each jurisdiction. At least the two counties probably would.
Chair Kim, that's correct. Not unlike you do with a transmission line for electrical facilities or a highway that may require an exception. You'd have to deal with that. So it really just depends on the situation.
Yeah. And the let's just hear a little bit more, Cindy, about the. It seems to me like the concern from people is on the farm side that maybe eminent domain's been used, so they don't really have quite the let's just work it out with the farmer because they've got eminent domain hanging over their head and or already utilized. So then if eminent domain's been utilized to at least take that part of the trail, just that portion that's the trail, then they want the conditional use because they lost all their negotiating ability once eminent domain got used and they no longer even own the trail. So then the conditional use would be the way to weigh in on what used to be their property.
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question, and I'm going to be very honest with you. I've never heard of eminent domain being used by one of my park groups, so it's hard for me to answer. And if it is, I'd be interested to hear what the ramifications of that have been. From my groups, and I have 62 park agencies, there hasn't been a problem. It's been a negotiation, and it's been a good negotiation. So,
Representative Clem, if I may, the issue here is not just about the landowners. You could have every landowner along the route say, we're happy with this, and we'll work with the trail people. It's about the agriculture in the area. If every landowner along the way agreed with that, but then the farmers that have to farm next to that have to deal with the shadow cast by that non-farm use, that's as much an issue as dealing with just the landowners who the trail would go through their land. And so what a conditional use permit does is it requires that you look at the implications to agriculture in the surrounding areas, not just to the land that the trail goes through itself.
Any other questions? Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious if anyone can help me sort out in my own mind. I assume on the face of it this is a use issue. But I've heard the agricultural community argue safety concerns. If it's a safety concern, then is that concern modified or not if there were an underpass or overpass? Or is this just genuinely a use issue, which in my mind is a separate set of considerations?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I would respond to you that it's probably both. A safety issue can be part of a land use concern. A safety issue can also just be a structural thing that's dealt with in terms of how something is built or the like. What the agricultural community is concerned about from a safety standpoint is the risk management that they have to deal with their land in terms of this introducing the public out into lands that otherwise the public would not be party to. I mean, you have to look at agricultural operations the same way you would look at as an industrial use. And the question I would have is it always appropriate to introduce the public into an industrial-like setting? It may be in some cases, and it may not in others. And of course, as you know, agriculture is very diverse in Oregon, 220 plus crops with probably 15, 20 different ag practices for each one of those types of crops. And so some practices may be compatible, some may not. We don't know that unless we go through a review process.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add in there, one of the things that is from my other hat of Union Pacific Railroad, a lot of the rails to trails pieces that come in here, that's already zoned one way. It's already a transportation use. And we're taking it to a lesser transportation by making it a trail. So it's not like we're coming into a corn zone or hops and saying we're going to put a trail right through here and affecting the neighbors next door. It's not that black and white.
To be honest, I don't really know that much about how trail or how rail is zoned. Seems like after it's zoned, it wouldn't be a few anymore, but that might not be true.
Representative Clem, usually trails, roads, railroads and the like are zoned the same as the underlying zone. So this trail, for example, or this railroad, for example, is zoned exclusive farm use. Railroads can be allowed in an exclusive farm use zone, and they go through the process and the like. But there's generally not a zoning designation for a linear-type facility. It's approved through the zoning process as a use within whatever the appropriate zone is, commercial, industrial, agriculture, forest, whatever.
The point being that it's already been approved for that land use for transportation.
Okay, any further questions? Great. Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3367, open a public hearing on House Bill 3457, ask Representative Widener to join us. And where's Mr. Roth? Is Mr. Roth here? Oh, no, I carried it over twice and now I've lost him.
Or anyone.
Anyone from Tax Fairness? Briefly tell us about your bill. I've stalled out your opposition apparently from being back today. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I am State Representative Jim Widener. I'm glad to hear there's no opposition to my bill here today, and thank you very much for doing that for me.
It wasn't on purpose, but you're welcome.
So, Chair Klim and distinguished members of the Committee on Rural Communities and Land Use and Water, thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 3457 today. For the record, my name is State Representative Jim Widener, and my district covers most of Yamhill County and Southwest Washington County. Those of us who represent areas of rural Oregon, we see that the recovery from the recession happens at a slower pace than the metro areas. This bill is intended to assist our rural business communities by expanding job opportunities through tax benefit incentives. This bill would establish a tax credit in rural communities if the business expands by adding at least 5 net full-time positions in rural area during a tax year. Furthermore, for the tax benefit eligibility, those 5 or more full-time positions must be available for at least 12 consecutive months, and the wage of those positions must meet or exceed the median wage for the county in which this business operates. If these requirements are met, then the amount of the tax credit shall equal 50% of the amount invested, but may not exceed $2 million or exceed the tax liability for the business. In addition, the business is required to receive written certification of eligibility from Oregon Business Development Department. This legislation would help spur economic development in the area of Oregon where we need it most. Please support the bill and consider scheduling a work session to offer relief to rural Oregon and our economy in rural Oregon. Thank you. And I'm open to any questions.
Questions for our colleague? Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Klim. Representative Widener, will there be cigar smoking allowed?
Mr. Chair, I see why you put the committee administrator between you and Representative Post. This could be a large danger in rural Oregon because we don't want forest fires that will spur more pollutants into the air.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative, for bringing any kind of initiative that's going to help us create more jobs in rural Oregon. I wanted to give you an opportunity to address some of my concerns here, because my sense of most employment in our rural areas is that we're dealing with small companies and seasonal companies. And in this piece of legislation, we're requiring year-round employment, and we're talking about adding at least 5 employees. So help me understand how this is going to help the smallest folks out in rural Oregon that are trying to get on their feet.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Gomberg, so what we're after here is trying to bring some stability. So this is bringing in companies that are looking at adding or establishing a business where it's going to be continued work that's there all the time for these rural communities. The seasonal work's always going to be there, and it's not going to change, but we're looking at expanding that base. This is income that's not there now, so even with it being a tax credit, it really isn't going to hurt the state. It'll be more of a benefit because we're creating an economy that just does not exist right now, and that's what I'm after with this bill, and that's what I'm trying to spur. So existing businesses, unless they were looking at expanding and putting on permanent positions that were running year-round, then this would help them. If they're not looking at doing that, it would not be a benefit to them.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Okay. You might, if you didn't get a chance, you might review the spreadsheet and the testimony from Mr. Roth, who's not here, and let us know if you have any opinions on it after you, if you haven't had a chance to see
it. Mr. Chair, I think that just shows that I have such a solid bill here that we need to get this moving and move it along. So, but yes, I will look at Mr. Roth's spreadsheet.
Quite an interesting little deal there. Like somehow it ends up being a 95% wage subsidy by the time he's done with his calculations. I'd be curious if it's the right math or the wrong math.
We'll take a look at that. I mean, the best thing to do, the reason I actually went this direction early on, I just started meeting with different groups and just seeing how to spur the economy the best. I'm usually not a fan of, you know, just doing a tax credit for a single industry or anything like that. But if you're trying to bring an industry or an individual to an area or to the state, you do tax incentives to bring them there, and you put as limited time frame on them, and that's what we're looking at here. And from what I've seen, this is the fastest way, either this or a capital investment tax credit are the two fastest ways to spur growth in the state of Oregon. So that's the reason we went here, and I'd talked to Paul in revenue about this, and that's where it came about.
Great. So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. Oh, sorry, that was the wrong one. House Bill 3457. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2723. Ivan, do you want to come up? And Representative Gilliam, since you co-sponsored with me, do you want to just tell us all about the bill?
I want to, but I don't think that is appropriate.
Oh, okay.
Good call.
Well, I'll comment just a little bit. The goal here is to allow for not require, but allow for cities or counties, if they want to have an area inside their boundary that people would still use for farming, even though it's clearly not the most profitable use, a way for the city or county to be able to offer tax relief to them during that time. There are some other programs that would allow them to do it, but they have some other limitations that we'll hear about. And this is one that's in use in a couple of states. For example, there's a group of people who were in front of our committee early in session. You might remember they were up in the city of Cornelius. Their land is now in the urban growth boundary, and they were kind of worried about losing their farm deferral because their zone automatically changes once they're brought into the either the city or the urban growth boundary. I can't remember what Cornelius's rules are. And I said, well, there may be a bill coming later that would give Cornelius a tool to still allow you to stay in farm use even though you're in the UGB. This is the bill I was referring to. So there's some opposition to it as well. We've got some amendments and maybe further amendments, but I'll let Ivan tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Chair Clem, members of the committee.
Just one second. Was that okay about our bill?
Yes, it was.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
For the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. Thank you for the opportunity to have a discussion on this bill today. As you noted, it relates to the creation of new urban agriculture incentive zones, which would be an optional tax incentive that counties and cities could afford landowners in urban areas who agree to five-year commitments for urban agriculture on their property. I wanted to give you just a quick overview of why this is important, and we could talk a little bit about the Dash 1 amendments because I think they address some of the concerns that have been raised, and it'll also help clarify what the bill ultimately would do. And I think the Dash 1 amendments really speak more to the intent of the bill. I guess I'll just start by saying that, you know, urban agriculture is something that's gaining quite a bit of importance as more and more entrepreneurs are raising vegetables, fruit, and livestock on undeveloped property within urban zones. These urban farms offer opportunities to alleviate food insecurity, provide easy access to farm fresh products, provide green spaces and improve quality of life in communities, and create opportunities for income for urban farmers. And they also help urban residents better understand how food is produced. However, as you well know, undeveloped urban land carries a very high tax burden, which provides an obstacle to success for urban farmers. This bill would assist urban farmers by allowing local communities to create urban agriculture incentive zones, which would be different from existing farm tax deferrals, where landowners would receive a property tax reduction if agreeing to allow urban agriculture to take place on their property for a minimum of 5 years. Under this bill, the landowner would enter into a contract with the city or county, agreeing to keep their unimproved land in agricultural use for a minimum of 5 years. And ultimately, this is important because it provides certainty for all those involved, whether it's it provides certainty for the local government, it provides certainty for the landowner, and it provides certainty for the urban farmer. And that minimum five-year commitment is also different from the existing farm tax deferral program that some non-EFU lands can already qualify for. During the five-year commitment, a significant reduction in property taxes would be realized. We've talked to a number of urban farmers. Several have actually submitted testimony. I'd urge you to check out OLIS because a number of urban farmers have submitted testimony talking about how this bill could affect them. The Oregon Farmers Market Association has also testified or submitted testimony in support. But these urban farmers report exceedingly high land leasing costs within urban areas as a serious obstacle to their success. But they also report that if their landlords were able to take advantage of this tax benefit, they would likely reduce their lease costs significantly. And having that five-year commitment is very important as a means to help develop, maintain, and grow these small businesses and help folks make longer-term plans where they're going to be 10 years from now, for example. So the last point I'd like to make is that this bill has checks and balances built in to ensure that if land is not actually being used for farming during the five-year period, it would be disqualified from the special tax assessments. And to speak to the Dash 1 amendment, one of the concerns that we heard was clarity that these urban agricultural incentive zones were for tax purposes only and would not impact buildable land inventories or urban growth boundaries. So the Dash 1 amendment, which is also on OLIS, I believe, directly speaks to that and makes clear that urban growth boundaries and buildable land inventories would not change as a result of these of this bill. Some of the other key elements of the Dash 1 amendments include clarifying the process for application, defining farm use the same way it is already defined in ORS 308A056, and essentially stating that the existing farm uses are defined in statute, but under this bill or under the amendment, a city or county that had an additional ordinance, for example, if they were to limit the number of livestock that you could have on an urban lot, that would also apply. And then also a key piece to this is that under the existing farm tax deferral program, you don't get the tax benefits until 3 years of farming have passed. So under this bill, you'd be able to access that benefit immediately. And you also would, and under the existing farm tax deferral, once your land goes out or is disqualified, you owe back taxes, which often can be a significant issue. Mm-hmm. Under this program, if you agree to the five-year commitment, it's simply a tax reduction for those 5 years. And assuming that you complete the five-year commitment, you would not owe back taxes during that time. So for a variety of reasons, this is an important new tool as we see it, and we hope that the Dash 1 amendments have helped clarify some of the a few of the concerns that we heard. Thank you.
Any questions for Ivan? Representative Gillian.
Mr. Chair, are there other testifiers on this?
Four more.
I'll hold my comments for that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Can you tell me if the League is going to testify on this bill?
Actually, no. We have two assessors, maybe. We did in the past. I think they're maybe, I know Department of Revenue is here, but is our Polk County assessor here? Great. So we have a local government person from Polk County, but I don't see the League of Oregon Cities even here, and they're not on the
team. May I ask a question? Sure.
Yeah.
Ivan, do you think that if we award a special tax assessment for agriculture, that it would be appropriate to do the same for urban forestry?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, 2 points on your question. Technically speaking, we already offer farm and forest tax deferrals for non-EFU or non-forest land. So, specific to this bill, since we're sort of creating a new pathway, our organization doesn't have an opinion on that. Since our focus of this, our support for this is around growing food, I just don't have an opinion on that. Others may. I don't. But logically speaking, it's not necessarily a large leap from here to there.
Thank you.
Good question, Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see any limitation on the size of land that could be subject to this bill.
Chair,
I think it says any urbanized area.
Right. Chair Clem, Representative Helm. So the way the bill or the Dash 1 amendment deals with this, there's no technically no limit on the land size. So but the Dash 1 amendment is where we sort of speak to that, in which by assessing the land similarly as to how we do it under existing ORS 308A.107, that speaks to the amount of income that you have to earn per acre under the existing farm tax deferral. So for example, on an area under 6 acres in size or 6.5 acres in size, you have to show $650 per year in income. And so we've tiered it directly to the existing income limits that are tied to the existing farm tax deferral. Additionally, so in that sense, that's one way in which the actual income is tied to the land size that would be looked at here. But secondly, we've tried to make clear that this deferral could apply to smaller sizes than the entire lot. It would only apply to the land actually being used for the agricultural purposes. So if you had a 2-acre lot and you're farming on a half acre, you would only get the assessment for that half acre.
Paul, but theoretically, if you had 100 acres that you wanted to try to bring under this program, you could try.
You certainly could. If your county or city designated your area as inside one of these urban agricultural incentive zones, you could certainly apply for that. And as long as you made the 5-year commitment and met the income tests, you would qualify.
Any other questions? Okay, great.
Thank you.
So, Mary Ann, and or do you even remember that you signed up for this many
yes.
weeks ago? You're welcome to come up if you still want to.
This is a new one.
Huh?
This is a new one.
Oh, this is today?
Yeah.
It's dated 3/31.
Am I the only one?
No. John Chandler. I'm still working off the old ones. Let me see who else signed up today. Okay. And Doug Schmidt. Actually, it's the same list from before. They're all extremely persistent. Why don't you go ahead and start and let us know if you are talking about the base bill or Dash 1s or both or whatever.
Yes, Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau and likely woefully underqualified to talk about tax law. However, I will persist. Our concerns about this bill I want to clarify, I think, my understanding of what the bill does. Under existing law, I'm reading right now from ORS 308A.068, any land that's not in an EFU zone but is being used or has been used in the preceding 2 years exclusively for farm use can qualify for farm use special assessment if it meets the income requirements and they have compliance with an application requirement. So my understanding is a lot of what this is getting at is that kind of first 2 years where folks would otherwise be ineligible, and as Ivan also discussed, some of the situations and where folks maybe have some other kind of more localized concerns associated with urban agriculture. Our concerns about this bill are pretty broad-based, just in terms of not quite understanding the impact it may have on kind of the policy behind the farm use special assessment and wanting to make sure that assessment remains as strong as possible. And so to the extent that this bill may weaken that or change that through allowing folks in urban areas, when we're thinking of kind of like the backyard farmer that's really not making much of an income off the property, we would ask that this bill sunset. And carry a sunset provision so that if there are unintentional impacts from allowing this type of special assessment, that we can revisit those once there's a chance to see how this may play out and how it may interact with the existing farm use special assessment, what kinds of conditions cities and counties are placing on it. So that's really my primary comment, and I am happy to take any questions with an understanding that I am by no means a tax expert. So thank you.
Did you have a time limit in mind?
I don't know what is common in tax law. I think I've heard 5 or 6 years is common.
I thought you were going to say like a month, and then we'll
you
see
know,
how it's gone. So
I think July 1st of this year is a really reasonable sunset date. So
maybe no. 5 years. That'd be one whole length of a contract cycle for a batch of people if some jurisdiction decided to take it up.
Right, but so those are kind of the crux of our concerns.
Okay, great. And then...
And I guess I would add to that with the dash ones, my understanding of the buildable lands issue. If these lands are not being counted toward the buildable land issue, we would retain the concern that that would cause further growth pressure on the UGB and impact farmland, which I think is going to be covered in another testimony.
It is, but I think it's probably the opposite of your concern. So
right.
We will, but we have a potential hybrid here. So let's hear about that real quick now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. This bill is troubling only because it tends to reopen an old fight we used to have about farmland inside of urban growth boundaries. And as all you all know, land inside of UGBs is presumed by law to be available for development. There's always going to be chunks that are not yet developable, and so the people owning them will oftentimes farm them. But going back a long time, we used to have quite a few squabbles about how do you count that land. Is it farmland getting farm use assessment? Is it pre-development land getting taxed at that rate? How do you do it? I'm sort of agnostic on the basic idea of this bill, but it concerns me, particularly in the dash ones, where it says this doesn't count for urban growth boundary purposes. If I understand, the intention is to create urban farms as a use. And an urban farm use is no different than an urban store use or an urban house use. It's a use. It may have a 5-year rolling cycle to it, but it's still, the intention is to have this be something more than a glorified garden, I presume. If that's the case, then that ought to count for UGB purposes, in our opinion, the same as any other use would. Even though it may be easier to turn an urban farm into a development activity than it would be a shopping center or something else, I'm not sure that that matters all that much in terms of the policy. Our hybrid idea, though, that I would suggest, and it would be a different amendment, there's a section in ORS 197-296 where it talks about how urban growth boundaries are to be calculated, where it lists off a number of things in the statute currently that local government is supposed to think about when they're calculating their land supply. In other words, with the buildable lands inventory and their supply of land for industrial and commercial, things such as power lines, easement, so on and so forth, we could add land receiving urban farm treatment, whatever we end up calling it, to that list. And that would allow the local governments to take into account, is this year 1 of a 5-year? Is it year 4 of a 5-year? Is it something that's had several renewals and is now a 15-year established use and probably isn't going to go anyplace? To at least at the local level see whether this land is ready for development. We'll mess up the numbers as far as UGB capacity is concerned without automatically putting it either in or out of those calculations. That strikes me as a good compromise. I hope it strikes you that way, and if so, we'd hope to get permission for a note to go meddle around in that statute to make this a little less of a problem for us. With any, I'll conclude there and take any questions you might have.
What do you think of that?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, that is troubling to me. I think the concept is interesting. But in terms of, you know, if it is a 15-year established use, that is, you know, that will then create additional pressure on the UGB if that land is not included in the buildable lands inventory, and create pressure out into more farmland. And so we'd kind of be trading one urban piece of farmland for a rural piece of farmland, and just that change in the system, I think, would be somewhat troubling.
Okay.
But I will give it further thought.
All right. the sad thing here is we're probably, no one's even going to use it. This is something I thought of with my former committee administrator, and we're just going to debate all day long about these like small little postage stamp things that don't matter to anybody but me. But okay. So let's hear about you. not that our bill isn't a beautiful piece of work, but I mean, I have no applicants demanding this at the moment either, or cities asking for it. So, in fact, they're not even here to comment on it. But you are, sir. So,
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor. I'm not here to argue the good or bad. I'm here to hopefully clarify a couple of issues in implementation administration. And the Dash 1 amendment does clear up a lot of the questions that I had from an administration point of view. There were a couple that I'm still not sure of yet. Is the intended use, can it just all be personal use and still qualify?
If somebody had a
small residential lot and they weren't using it, could they grow their own food and qualify for a special assessment if they weren't using it for a community garden? I wasn't quite sure if there was any income requirements. I am going to talk to the person who testified earlier about that. Is the unimproved land, is it the whole parcel has to be unimproved? You could have a 2-acre piece of property with a small shop on it. Is that improved? And would that exclude this from qualifying? So I'm not sure on some of those more of administration type questions, and those may be cleared up in rule, which may have been the intent all along. And is the intent of this bill to allow any land to qualify for this? There's a, you know, if you took a half acre of commercial land in West Salem, it'd be about almost $300,000. The farm use value on that would be about $500, if it's specially assessed. So they'd be losing about $4,000 in tax if it was a commercial. So I wasn't sure if this was available to all unimproved land or not.
Any urbanized area of the city or county.
So it would include any type of zoned land there.
That the city or county chose.
Chose to allow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And the farmland values are typically determined based off of rent that a farmer will pay for the land based on the class of the soil and the area of the county that's in. Currently, we don't have any rents or anything for urbanized areas. So we have multiple values of specially assessed land. And in an urbanized area, we have no determination of which of those values to put on that. I would probably use the highest specially assessed value, which is only a little over 2,000 an acre in Polk County. So if you cut that back to a very small piece of property, it's not a lot of value. So those were just a couple of the issues that still weren't sure if had been clarified yet, or if they were intended to be clarified in rule. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Okay, great. Questions for this group? Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Chandler. Again, tonight, the first question about size. Do you think that we could reach a relatively modest size of parcel that we could apply this type of concept to that would reduce the uncertainty? I think this is a really cool idea.
Yes.
But it is a really cool idea. It's cool because it allows people to farm in the urban area to a certain extent and also reduce transportation costs and all that stuff. All that stuff is really good. But, you know, we just passed a couple of bills out of the committee on Damascus. If Damascus had had this type of tool available to it, they would have designated their entire area as one of these things and tried to keep it from urbanizing forever. And that's a big problem for these urban areas that are trying to look ahead and plan adequately and keep the urban growth boundary moving ahead at a reasonable speed. I would hate to see a cool idea like this misused for a purpose that was unintended. So my question, again, back to, there was a question.
I was waiting for the punctuation, Representative.
Could we do it on a smaller scale, you know, less than 10 acres or something like that, and reduce the uncertainty on the buildable lands inventory?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, perhaps. I hadn't really done that deep much thinking about it, to be perfectly honest, other than just recognizing that there was an issue created for taking land out of production that kind of wasn't or maybe was. The smaller, the better. I think you might run in there to, and this gets more into the merits of the bill than my particular concern, the smaller you get, the more it looks like a non-commercial use potentially. And that, but again, I'm trying to stay, like I said, agnostic about the underlying notion. It might be more tied to the size of the community. 10 acres in a very small town may be a much bigger deal than 10 acres in the metropolitan area. But I understand what you're saying, and there may be some tailoring that could be done to address those concerns. But as I said in my testimony, I think you could also just simply get the locals a chance to look at this and see if this is an established use. I mean, if the idea here, it does run somewhat antithetical to the notion of our land use system in some ways, that everything within the UGB develops. I personally think that might be wrong-headed just because not everybody wants to live in the Pearl District, and having some areas like this may help, particularly in a smaller town, like you said, diminish transportation demand and all that. That's something for the locals to decide if this is a use. They want to have a farm in what they thought was going to be a industrial area. That's up to them, but they had to at least call it out and then figure out where to put the industrial land that was going to, the industrial uses that were going to go there someplace else, either inside or outside the boundary. That's all I'm looking for, is a way to get that balance back. An acreage size may do it. A timeline, maybe instead of 5 years, it'll be 10 years. I mean, I'm thinking out loud here, obviously. But some way of making sure that these don't just turn into a way to not move boundaries when it's necessary, or a way to force development pressure elsewhere than what it would otherwise go. How's that for a extended mumble?
If we could require that a city with a comp plan, only with a comp plan, can use it. That land use jokes. That's just terrible.
So I
get it.
I think, okay. I have one more witness on this, so I'll excuse you. I think the issue for us probably is the inherent check is the cities and counties probably aren't likely to give away much tax revenue anyway, unless they're trying to achieve a certain objective, I would guess. And also, people using their land this way are giving away a whole lot of opportunity cost by using it for farming. So there's a natural either insanity or check on how much would happen, because you're losing money left and right by farming instead of developing it in the metro area anyway. I didn't call the other person while I was soapboxing. John Phillips, can you come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Department of Revenue. The department is neutral on this bill. I'd like to make my comments address both the bill and the Dash 1 amendments. We provided some extensive comments on the bill itself, dealing with application, qualification, use, definition, disqualification, et cetera, kind of the mechanics of tax administration. So I really applaud the committee for tackling tax administration in this committee. That's great. Appreciate it. It's really an exciting thing to be doing. But anyway, I'm happy to say that for the most part, the Dash 1 amendments address the concerns that I expressed in my summary of comments. So I want to thank you for doing that. I suspect that because if it passes, it would be a new program, and there might be some discussion we might need to have during the interim or after we've had some experience with processing some of these. So I would just encourage, I would just let you know that I'll be following up with the chair if we need further clarification and legislation in the future if this passes. So thank you very much.
Great.
Any questions for me?
Any questions for John? No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have no questions. Yeah. I did want to mention how grateful I am you dragged me in on this bill. And it's always embarrassing when our vice chair has better ideas than we do. But I would say this. This is a good attempt at a difficult situation. Land use is always a difficult situation. We are trying to always protect traditional farming. But to deny this creative kind of urban farming is to stick your head in the sand based on things that we've been to together in my district in Molal. I'm glad that Ivan was here. Ivan used to be a constituent. He's moved, looking for better representation. But this is a real issue, and I think if we continue to discuss this with people like Brother Chandler, who I doubt is agnostic point of view, and others for input, with sideboards, with possible sunsets, I like the idea of my colleague here saying, what about urban forestry? It would have to have a longer sunset because of the trees. But even if we're not ready for prime time, I hope we continue to discuss this, because these are two kinds of farming, particularly in my district,
who need to find ways to meld and continue going forward.
I like your summation there. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2723 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3412 and ask Vice Chair Hahn to tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This this bill would require and authorize the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, DOGAMI, to do some planning around landslides. And the reason that we brought this bill forward is it's really a companion bill, in my mind, to another bill that we heard earlier. We had a public hearing on earlier this session, which was 2633, which sought to give DLCD some guidance on planning for all sorts of natural hazards, including earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, etc. And what this bill primarily does is it tells DOGAMI to go forward and do some LIDAR mapping. And LIDAR is a laser-based mechanism that allows mapping of landslide areas, and is a helicopter flyover, and it's very effective in finding either present or historic landslides in any area. And that's what the bill does. I believe that we will continue to see some movement forward on the Goal 7 bill, and it would be nice to have this bill move forward at the same time so that we could give DLCD the mapping tools that they need to do part of their work. It will have a fiscal because it will require some amount of money to give DOGAMI a budget to do that mapping. Other than that,
Any questions now, or folks want to hear testimony and then could take questions? Okay, then let me have Ian Maiden or Madden and Heath Curtis and Matt Crawl from DLCD. Come on up. Wow. Should we dim the lights a little? Should we dim the lights a little?
If that makes it better.
Yeah. Okay. Ian, I've got you first.
Okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the interim state geologist and director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, henceforth known as DOGAMI, to save us all time. And I'd like to talk to you today about our perspective on HB 3412. And because I'm a geologist, I kind of have to have a map to wave at here. So if you will indulge me with some graphics, we'll try to make this as entertaining as possible. So for the record, the department is neutral on this bill, but I would like to talk to you about Oregon's landslide history and situation, and a little bit about what the department is currently doing and is capable of doing with respect to mapping and mitigating landslide hazards. So,
okay, but not too long, because we've got a bunch of other bills, so should
yes,
kind of focus
I'll,
on the bill itself
I'll
a little bit.
So, first off, I don't have to go into much detail about okay. The fact that Oregon has a history of landslides. We've seen these happen throughout the years. We estimate that the annualized losses in the state are about $10 million a year. And in some years, like 1996-97, we had 9,000 reported landslides. And the reason for that geologically, the reason we are landslide prone is that we have geology that includes a lot of relatively weak rocks. We have a very, very wet climate. We have very steep topography, particularly in the Cascades and Coast Ranges. And on top of that, we have a Cascadia subduction zone offshore that shakes the entire state severely every 500 years. And all of that combines to make very unstable ground. So over the years, DOGAMI has a statutory duty to prepare geologic hazard studies and to try to mitigate geologic hazards working with local communities, of course, including landslides. We've been mapping landslides since 1937 as part of our ongoing geologic mapping process, and in the 70s, we actually moved into doing systematic countywide environmental land mapping geology studies that included landslides. And all of this work sort of culminated in 2008 with the map that you see here, which is our statewide landslide information database for Oregon, or SLIDO, that shows all the landslides that we know about in the state as of 2008. And at that time, there was about 12,000 landslides in the database. This is the culmination of all the geologists working in Oregon for the last century. Gotta go back. And then came LIDAR. As Representative Helm said, LIDAR is a laser-based topographic mapping process that collects extremely detailed maps of the ground surface. So the example that you see here is an area in Washington County along the Tualatin River. On the far left, you see an aerial photograph, heavily forested area. In the center, you see what we call a bare earth LIDAR image, which has basically removed all the vegetation. So now we can see incredible detail underneath the woods. You can see there's a road that runs down through there. And then we can outline the landslide, which is the features that you see in the right-hand image outlined in yellow and orange. So the LIDAR data allows us to find essentially all landslides and to map them with accuracy of a meter or better. And it has really dramatically changed the way that we can do this mapping. And to give you a little example of that, this map shows in pink the areas that we have covered so far in the state with LIDAR. About 30% of the state has been covered to date. And the areas in lavender are the areas that we have completed LIDAR-based landslide inventories for. And so that area in lavender is about 2% of the state. And in that area, we have found 22,000 landslides in the last 5 years in comparison to the 12,000 landslides that were found in the last century. If you extrapolate that 22,000 landslides and the 2% of the state throughout the entire area where we have LIDAR, that's 400,000 landslides waiting to be found. And if you extrapolate it over the entire state, it's 1 million landslides waiting to be found. The other thing to keep in mind is that it's taken us 6 or 7 years to complete that 2% of the state. At the rate we're going, it will take 350 years to complete the state. So why are we worried about mapping existing landslides? Well, obviously, the Oso landslide, a recent disaster, reminds us that existing landslides are the most likely place to see future activity. And so it's the best indicator of where future problems will be. So if you don't know where the existing landslides are and can't avoid developing on them, or don't know that you have developed on them, you can't really avoid the risk that they'll be reactivated. Most large landslides are stable just for the moment, and if you disturb them by adding water or doing earth moving or shaking them with an earthquake, they will pick up and move again. In addition to being able to map all the landslides and inventory them, we're able to do risk studies once we complete those. So we define all the areas that are at high risk from landslides, and then we use GIS data to overlay buildings, roads, power lines, water systems, so that we can determine what is out there that is actually at risk from the landslide. So this is an example from a study we did for Clackamas County, and you can see in the table there that there's a total of 3,100 buildings located on known existing landslides. All of those buildings are at risk from reactivation of those landslides if people are unaware that the risk is there and are careless about how they manage that land. So we've developed a sort of a procedure to go from LIDAR data to landslide inventory to risk map, and then eventually to mitigation activities with the local community. And that's a really important part, is that you have to work with the local community or with fellow state agencies like ODF or DLCD for that final mile to turn this information into some kind of a locally appropriate response. All the projects that we've done to date have been paid for by outside parties. So in essence, what we do is we wait for someone to come to us and say, I have money, I want a landslide study. Typically, that money comes from FEMA after an area has had a declared disaster. there is usually some grant money available. So that's, for instance, why we have done Astoria and Silverton and the southwest part of Clackamas County, because those areas all had disasters and were able to come and provide us with money. But the important point is that we don't initiate projects because we don't have our own source of funds for this. So just to underscore that, without consistent funding, we can't actually run our own program that follows statewide priorities. We are reacting to money that comes from other people. The governor's recommended budget includes $287,000 in new general fund for the agency to support a program very much like the one that is outlined in HB 3412. If that money becomes available, it will allow us to start conversations with communities, but we will still need partners to complete these projects, and we'll still be completing projects at that 350 years to complete the state rate. So, sort of to summarize, we have a huge landslide risk. We have state-of-the-art technology and data that allows us to go out and characterize this and determine both the risk and the hazard and to work with local communities to find solutions. We simply do not have the resources to carry this out in any sort of systematic fashion. And with that, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Okay, Heath.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm here representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And I appreciated Representative Helms' summary of the bill up front. Some of my testimony focuses on some ambiguity, which may not perfectly align with that summary, so it may be that I'm mistaken. But before I get to the specifics of the bill, I thought I might offer just a little bit of history around this issue. As you may know, I've been with OFIC for a couple years now, and this is my first opportunity to wade into the landslides issue. It was remarkable to me when this topic came up. People started literally walking into my office with giant folders full of material and putting them on my desk and saying, you should know this. And unfortunately, I still largely don't. But what I can tell you is that there's a lot to know in this field. Most of it came from Senate Bill 12 in 1999. So in 1996, there was a tragic landslide that prompted immediate legislation in 1997, which put a moratorium on some development activities and required a task force report. And unlike some of the recent task forces reporting to this body, that one actually turned around its report in less than a year. In October of 1998, under the leadership of Gail Ackerman, they produced a report, came back to this legislative body and said, we need a Senate bill that included a number of components, and that generated Senate Bill 12. Senate Bill 12 kind of captured this idea of shared responsibility. And this is an interesting concept to me that I heard for the first time a couple weeks ago. But in the context of land use, and you have two competing developers, the question becomes, whose job is it to avoid the bad outcome, right, or the undesirable outcome? And in that context, I think that Senate Bill 12 tried to strike a balance between, I think, development pressures, between logging pressures, between environmental pressures. And so under that bill, there were several components. One is that Dogami was supposed to undertake a large mapping effort of further review areas. And then local governments, not Dogami and not a state agency, but local governments were supposed to adopt land use regulations for development in those further review areas to try and control how much was being developed in hazardous areas. ODF, the Oregon Department of Forestry, was supposed to put in place rules to regulate logging in high hazard landslide areas that posed a risk to the public. ODOT was supposed to identify and warn motorists that may be entering hazardous areas. And DLCD was charged with helping those local governments enforce those regulations. So there's this large effort underway, and Dogami actually generated a lot of those maps. And the maps identified just a huge swath of Oregon as being high hazard landslide areas. And a number of the local jurisdictions didn't actually observe those when setting their own land use regulations. It was so comprehensive, it was very difficult for them to build in actual policies at the local level. That's as I understand it. However, Dogami now has this new powerful tool available to it in the form of LIDAR and assessing landscape level risk. funding that effort to us is actually a really good idea. Identifying where there could be conflict and accounting for that is appropriate. I mean, that's what we do here. However, House Bill 3412 uses some pretty big language. It charges Dogami with developing a comprehensive landslide hazard mitigation program. And in this context, I'm not entirely certain I even know what the word hazard means. It's the only substantive word guiding the agency's work. And to the extent that the bill actually calls for Dogami to develop mitigation measures, hazard mitigation measures that are area specific, those in some ways conflict with Senate Bill 12, specifically as I'm familiar with it, with the Oregon Department of Forestry's work under 527.630 and 527.710. If in fact Dogami is going to have a new regulatory authority for mitigating hazards, it's not at all clear to me how that would work with the existing body of law, which is substantial, surrounding landslide hazard mitigation. And so I would pose to you that House Bill 3412 appears to the casual observer to be a rather casual venture into this big body of law, and it injects Dogami into some pretty sensitive conversations. It may be that the bill's not designed to do that and that it could be further refined. To the extent that the bill is trying to get at giving Dogami the resources to complete its mapping and to reach out proactively to local jurisdictions, we're 100% in favor of that. So with that, like everybody says, the generic phrase is, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Matt Kroll.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Matt Kroll. I work for the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. We are neutral on this bill, but I am here to share with you a little bit of context and some background. I think two themes will come out of that, and one is a close cooperation between Dogami and DLCD on these, and the second is the importance of the kinds of detailed information that we've been talking about here today from the LIDAR. Would mention that we've been cooperating with Dogami on, you saw some maps of the Clackamas County area, and those maps were produced in part because the cities in Clackamas County and the county raised the funds to help have Dogami prepare those maps, and DLCD has agreed to work with Dogami and the cities and counties to help them prepare, well, what do you do with these maps? What kind of things would the cities and counties change in their plans or their own zoning regulations? I regret to say that we have not been as effective at doing that as we would like to so far. We're very willing to do that, but our staff time is at times limited, which is why you may notice that in the budget, the governor's recommended budget for DLCD, there is an option package that would add some additional staff time at DLCD because we are very interested in continuing to cooperate with Dogami and to work on these landslides. And I can say that I'm enthusiastically in support of that. I do not have to be neutral on that bill. But these So that's one example of where Dogami and DLCD work together and put this information to good use. Another is that DLCD has recently been funding Dogami to work on a question of channel migration along streams. This is a particular kind of landslide, a little bit different, but again, the LIDAR information gives you some very good information about the hazards and the ways that those streams can jump their banks and be very dangerous. Right now, Dogami is working on doing a statewide assessment, not of to map the actual areas where it could move, but to talk about the probability or the susceptibility of each stream segment. It would be a much more detailed level to get that LIDAR information and to actually map the areas that are hazardous along each channel migration zone. And I also mentioned that floods. The LIDAR data is very helpful in understanding floods, and we work with Dogami on several examples there out in Harney County in the Silvies watershed to get much more detailed information and use that to help cities and counties respond to those hazards. So with those two themes, how Dogami and DLCD work together to try to help on these hazards, help local governments, and the value of this detailed information, that's what I share with you today.
Any questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might make a comment along with a possible question.
Sure.
I'm troubled by the breadth of this bill, and based on the testimony provided from Dogami and the fact that it might take us 3.5 centuries to complete the study, I think in the interest of public safety, it might make sense to limit that to the urban growth boundary, and I agree completely with Mr. Curtis that the mapping would be extremely helpful not only for forestry but probably a number of other departments as well. But I too think that this bill may be in conflict with forestry. In the wake of the extensive landslides that Mr. Curtis mentioned occurred in 1996, there were extensive number of studies that were done on landslides and forested acreage in Oregon. As was pointed out in testimony by Dagami, that there are things that tend to trigger landslides, rain being one of them. That tends to happen in the Coast Range a lot, and that is a geologically active area. And there tends to be natural landslides there. Point number one, it would be difficult to put a mitigation program into effect when you don't know what the triggers are. That's number one. Number two, in terms of forestry, some of the results of those studies found that very young forests, extremely young forests, and very old forests are prone to higher rates of landslides. I'm not sure that requiring Dogami to develop a comprehensive landslide hazard mitigation program would be appropriate for old growth timber stands when the mitigation would undoubtedly have to be the liquidation of that old growth timber. So I just think that some of this is inappropriate and would be better managed by the Department of Forestry. But the mapping and the information, I think, could be exceedingly helpful with a focus on the urban growth boundary. Thank you.
Chair Clem, I may just offer that Representative Witt, it's quite possibly that he knows a great deal more than me about this issue. In fact, his name was on many of the materials that showed up on my desk in those binders. As a former Board of Forestry member, I would defer to his counsel.
Okay, any further questions? All right. That's all I've got on this bill, unless there's anybody else I've missed. Okay. Seeing that, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3412 and open a public hearing. I think we should just do it. We have time.
Okay.
Is that okay? On House Bill 3416, and we're going to ask Vice Chair Helm to tell us about this one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3416 makes the suggestion that we might consider moving to an attorney's fees system for Land Use Board of Appeals decisions. Some of you might know that since LUBA's beginning, as I understand it, attorney's fees have never been awarded to the winning party. It's always been everybody, each side bears their own costs. And in the case of one side winning over the other, they are not assessed with the attorney's fees from the winning side. This bill is making a lot of people really nervous on both sides of the land use system. And we were just looking at the sign-up list. There are of the 5 or 6 parties that are signed up to testify, 4 of those are both for and against. The reason I brought this bill is not for the bill, for the concept itself necessarily. It's because we're having a larger conversation about local appeals fees for land use matters, appeal fees, appealing a hearings officer's decision to the city council or a planning commission decision to the city council. There's been, over the past few years, rising concern that in some jurisdictions the local governments have decided to hike those fees up so high that they're foreclosing local folks from participating in the land use process. And the parties on both sides of that issue have not been able to agree over the past few years.
I'm very much involved in that bill, and I'm sorry I can't remember the bill number right now. It's on the Senate side, and I hope that it comes over to the House, and I hope that this committee gets to talk about it. It seems to me that inherent in that conversation is the issue of LUBA attorney fees. And if we need to have that discussion, I just wanted to have this bill on the table in case we needed it. It very well may be that we don't, and I hope we don't. But that's the gist of this bill. And if you have any questions for me, I can answer them.
Any questions for the Vice Chair at this point? Okay. Why don't we start with Steve McCoy, Jonathan Manton, and Bob Olson.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am.
You know what? Stay right there for a second.
Okay.
I might lose a quorum. So let me temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3416. And let me open a work session on House Bill 2460. Now, colleagues, this is a long time ago. Danelle, can you come up? This was a long time ago. There was the issue of the DSL having a desire to get some, basically, a program to be able to in order to grant permission for utility facilities going across state lands. And the utilities all came fairly upset about that. So we believe we have worked something out with the utilities, and Danelle's going to represent them in mass here and tell us about these dash fours.
Thank you, Chair Clem. For the record, Danelle Romaine representing the Oregon PUD Association. And speaking, we have a general group of all the electric utilities and some of the natural gas utilities. We've been working closely with DSL on this bill. We think we have a good bill in the form of the Dash 4 amendments, and we're all in support of it. It basically adds a new fee for easements outside of cities on state lands and clarifies some other things about multiple crossings under one application.
Any questions for Danelle?
I don't know if it's for Danelle.
The DSL's here too, probably somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe you can answer it.
Okay.
It might be the best. I have a note to myself. I was uncomfortable with it because it raises fee. And I don't know that that's been answered yet.
So I
dash four.
Yeah. So what we heard was that the costs were currently being borne out of the state school fund, and they were trying to get to some level of reimbursement for. It's accurate to say it would raise fees because currently there isn't one on this particular kind of activity. They pay a lot of fees on other things, but not in this particular activity. And so what we heard was there was a desire to get to some kind of cost recovery. So instead of having the school fund pay for these applications, that the users would pay for their own applications, basically. And we didn't know how much that might would be. We thought it could be a ton. In the testimony, it sounded like it might be 25 grand or something like that a year in total. But we wanted to put sideboards on it.
Yeah, that's correct, Chair Clem. And to your point, Representative Post, the utilities feel comfortable about this because we actually included the fee in statute, so we have some assurances that it's not going to increase, be increased by the department. There's currently a fee for these type of applications inside cities, and this just expands it basically to outside of cities. So we feel comfortable that it's a small enough fee that it's something that we can all absorb.
So it's not necessarily a new fee. It's an expansion of the area that the fee the fee covers, but locking in the fee into statute so it wouldn't just change through agency action.
That's correct.
Does that help?
Yeah.
There's Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many members of the association?
We have a Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, we have five PUDs within our PUD association. All of the electric utilities meet in a group, the investor-owned utilities, the consumer-owned utilities, that includes the munis, the co-ops, PG, PacifiCorp, Idaho Power, Northwest Natural, Avista, Cascade, others.
Thank you.
Do you want to hold off a little bit on this one still?
No, I'm okay. Yeah,
okay, all right. So I would take a dash four amendment motion if you've got one.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash four amendments dated 3/31/15.
A Vice Chair Post moves the dash four amendments dated 3/31/15. Moves to adopt the dash four amendments dated 3/31/15. Is there any discussion? I just want to thank the department for working with our interested payers of the fee to work out something that would take away the issue of, you know, robbing my daughter's school fund by those dirty, greedy utilities, and now we get that off the table. It's a technical term, but yeah. Any further discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2460 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2460 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Dahlberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Excused.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. The last time somebody left, I gave it, and that became kind of. I'll carry this one. I can use my. Should I not use my dirty big utility line? Maybe not. I won't use that on the floor. We'll just like benevolent, wonderful utility.
The last time you did it, it turned out really well.
Yeah.
The guy that got stuck did a good job.
I know, and then it became this.
Thank you.
Okay, well, since McLean's not here, let's move his bill. let me open a work session on House Bill 3147.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 3147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and then it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Colleagues and rule, this will, I'm sure it's got a fiscal with it. I don't know what the fiscal is, but rulemaking type fiscal, 150 grand, so we'll have to work on this down in Ways and Means, Representative Gomberg and I. And this is the evaluate opportunities to decrease time required to site and develop industrial uses bill. Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Excused.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill sent to Ways and Means. And 2830. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2830. There's a dash three amendment. Do you want to tell us about that? Do you know about that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Dash two and dash three. But I think we got everything.
You combined it.
So, folks, you remember this is a bill that deals with remands from the Land Use Board of Appeals and how much time the local governments have to process those. I received some comments from interested parties on that about when to start that 120-day processing period and whether if the local government didn't take, if the applicant didn't take up the remand at all, that automatically the application would be terminated. I believe that I've got the interested folks at least to neutral here on it, and I think it's ready to go to the floor.
Now, I don't remember who commented on this at the time. Mr. Chandler? And are you to neutral? Okay. Yeah. Neutral to good, huh? All right.
You want to overstate.
Yeah, no, that was good. Okay. Who's got the script?
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 3/19/15.
Vice Chair Post moves the Dash 3 amendments dated 3/19/15. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they're approved.
Chair Clem, I move that House Bill 2830 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2830 to the floor as amended to, or as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Graham?
Aye.
Representative Palmer?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Excused.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes, and we'll ask Vice Chair Helm to carry that bill. Okay, and then I'm going to announce a carryover on 3169. Got one more question for Representative Benz I need to check on. The work session on 3169. Okay, sorry, gentlemen. Back to, let me reopen the public hearing on 3416. And if, I mean, you heard the explanation, I'm not sure how much time you want to spend on it, but a little would be good. We got one more bill just to talk about briefly, so I'll keep you up there while we do that.
Okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I will be brief. Goal one of Oregon's land use program is to develop a citizen involvement program that ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. Appeals are a phase of the planning process. When, for example, a citizen brings a case on an ambiguous provision in law, we fear that this would have a chilling effect on such cases because they would fear having to pick up their costs as well as the other side's costs. This would make it more difficult to define the contours of new provisions of law. On top of what Vice Chair Helm mentioned with local appeal fees, we feel like heaping more on top is potentially problematic. Thank you.
Jonathan.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm here today representing Central Oregon Land Watch. Land Watch has been operating in Central Oregon for coming up on 30 years now as an advocacy organization that also does a lot of education promoting sound solutions to lessen the tension within our land use system. We advocate for protecting special places and natural resources both for this and future generations and the same fair, open, and accessible decision-making processes that Steve just highlighted. I very much appreciate Representative Helm for having this conversation about the appropriate fees. The first step is, of course, the filing fee, and that fee should be fair and accessible for folks to have their day in court. We don't want to set the filing fees at such a high point that only those with resources can access our courts and those who don't have resources cannot. The next step, of course, is if someone is a bad actor and they're getting punished by the court for, to require them to pay the other side's attorney's fees because they have brought a frivolous claim, or in this case, what LUBA already spells out, and it's not... It's not discretionary. It's currently a direction. It's in the, on page 3 of the bill. It's on line 39. It spells out the standard there that it's the that would be deleted by the bill, and that's that if the LUBA board finds that you've advocated a position that's not well funded in law, or that the information is not supported by the facts, you shall award attorney's fees, and that's already the current law at LUBA. And we think that it makes sense to have, when you're talking about awarding one side's attorney's fees to the other, you do that appropriately if they have been a bad actor, and it's entirely appropriate to deter frivolous claims in that way, and that's already the law at LUBA, and we just want the fees to reflect that the entry fee should not be in any case such that it's so high that you deny entry to the court for people based on those who have resources or who don't. And so filing fees should be fair and reasonable, and then we think it's entirely appropriate to use awarding of attorney fees when someone has been a bad actor. But when you're awarding attorney fees to get into court, or in this case, just because you lost the decision, then you'd have a real chilling effect on access to the courts. And just very quickly, Land Watch, for example, has been the prevailing party approximately 70% of the time of its cases at LUBA. They've averaged almost between one and two cases a year. And for Land Watch, if you were to lose, if to have to pay attorney's fees on the other side of the case just for losing, you wouldn't be able to afford to do it at all. So you could win 70% of the time, but if you lose one or two, then with a small budget citizen organization, then your entire budget would be wiped out. So it would basically eliminate the ability for Central Oregon Land Watch to bring forth lawsuits. So we would oppose the bill. Thanks.
Don't tempt him. No, you're not representative. You're Aaron Doyle.
I am. Yeah. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I think we've all found a appeals fee cuff shifting that we agree upon. We also oppose this bill. I had a really long diatribe on what it means to be a prevailing party under Oregon law, but I think I'll skip that because time. But suffice it to say that the reason why we use fee shifting is to basically, for those who enter court with bad faith or vexatious litigant, all of those things which LUBA is already required to shift fees if that's what's occurring. If a city walks in and says, we just like the rules that we set, we have no foundation in the state land use goals, LUBA will say that's insufficient and you should pay their costs for being here. And same on the other side. And I believe that system is currently working for that part. I know that we are part of a long-term ongoing, not discussion, but very controversial back and forth on the local appeals fees process. And it is a very difficult balance for local governments when we set those fees, which is related to the premise of what Representative Helm is bringing this conversation forward on, is that when our hearings officer or our planning commission makes a decision, you can appeal it up to the city council or county commission, and there's a wide variety of latitude that we're provided in statute right now related to those fees. And some of our jurisdictions have opted to charge cost, and some have opted to charge nominal fees, and some have opted to go somewhere in between. And that is a very difficult budget-oriented conversation that we have at the local level, and we've been unsuccessfully having that conversation with Central Oregon Land Watch, and Thousand Friends, and we understand their concerns, but I don't think that this particular drive at the issue is going to solve it for anyone, given the difficulty of deciding who's prevailing in a land use decision that can come back and forth between LUBA and the local government multiple times. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan, despite your jabs at me in your testimony, over and over, the bad actor thing, I got that.
Oh.
I don't want to see you lose your opportunity, but I would say it is difficult for me listening to testimony to believe completely that our land use system and litigation is working just fine statewide. That's a little hard to stomach, and it doesn't mean that this is a stab at it is necessarily the solution, but I am for more responsible approaches, less litigation, but both sides taking responsibility. You don't have to comment on that, but I appreciate, if nothing else, the discussion about moving that way that this bill brings.
Chair Clem and Representative Gilliam, bad acting references aside, I want to make sure that you understand that's not my testimony. It's not that I think everything in the land use system is perfect at all. And one example of that is what we're talking about here, where you can have a city or a county charge $5,000 as their appeal fee. In one instance, it's $14,500 to appeal to your county commission. So citizens can't participate at that point at all. It does create a system. And we did a bill, I think, last session to get LUBA to report on what's actually happening with how many cases are brought and who's winning and what's going on there. And so I'd love to follow up with you afterward and talk about that, because we're happy to have the conversation, and we all want a system that works efficiently and is accessible to all, and people are not abusing it. And we want to make those decisions based on the facts of what's actually happening. And I think we either supported or were neutral on that bill to look at that last session, and I would love to talk to you about those results further.
Thank you. Okay, let me, Steve, can you stay, and then I'll have Bob and Steven come up in my last two. Quickly tell us about that, and then we can chat about the other bill.
Hey, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steven Kafuri. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. The American Planning Association represents land use planners, land use lawyers, citizen members of land use planning commissions, planning directors. So we represent people on all sides of these issues, people who work for government, people who challenge government. And our sole issue is to make sure that the land use planning system works as well as can be. I will talk just about this bill, not about any bill that's in the Senate. And that is very quickly, I agree with Aaron Doyle. This is a problem for both sides. If they have to, would be facing the threat of attorney's fees, it would inhibit both sides from bringing things. So it's not just keeping citizens from coming to the appeals process. It's also theoretically, well, not theoretically, actually a problem for cities and counties and how they make their decisions. They ought to be making their decisions on what they think is best for their citizens, not on the potential attorney fees that they might be losing. And that would be a factor if this bill passes. So we oppose the bill.
And Bob.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Olson, representing the Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Sorry about my lack of voice today, but I just wanted to express that we also have reservations about this bill. And even though the Friends of the Gorge have not had an appeal before LUBA in many years, as far as I know, they still have concerns. We believe this bill would be an unnecessary burden for developers, local governments, and citizens. Such parties can experience a chilling effect. They can incur big expenses if they do not prevail in the case. So we recommend that you make it more difficult to appeal land use decisions. Thank you.
Any questions? With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3416. I need to carry over House Bill 3213, or am I just rescheduling?
It was killed, or it was taken off the agenda.
Oh, till next week, yeah. Sorry. Then let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3431, and I will just fill you in, colleagues, on my side. I think I introduced the bill, or it's a committee bill, but if not, I introduced another version of this bill. So only Representative Gilliam was here for this and probably doesn't want to talk about it, but at one point we had a debate in the chamber about protections from development around the Metolius River. There was two groups of developers who were in the middle of a process with their county to try and get a map finalized for building resorts in that area. And prior to that process finishing, the legislature acted and passed what's called an area of critical concern in that area that limited development below or above 10 units. The two developers who were in the midst of the process were granted, under the terms of that management plan of the area, what are called transferable development opportunities, which is you could use your existing housing rights on the property that you had, which in the case of one was around 125 units and the other was two, or you could apply for a transferable development opportunity. And both of the two developers applied for the transferable development opportunity, interestingly enough. And we have had that opportunity on the books now for 6 years. It's been renewed at least once. And what my conversations in particular with the folks who only had two housing rights, actually, let me modify. That one in particular, the management plan said either they could build 25 permanent, no, it was 35 units total. Anyway, they could build a 35-unit project at the Metolius, or the Legislative Assembly granted them a transferable development opportunity. We granted them a transferable development opportunity, so that put their home rights back down to two, and they've shifted to this transferable development opportunity. They have spent a lot of time in a really bad housing market trying to find partners to build a resort and didn't have a lot of luck, mostly because of the bad housing market, or at least in part because of the bad housing market. So we've been in conversations with them, and we being Vice Chair Helm and I and Thousand Friends, for several months now, trying to work out what else about the transfer development opportunities aren't useful and aren't helpful, because the goal is to have them be useful, for from my perspective at least. So I just wanted to give a little update, because we have a draft bill back, but it's not yet in LC format, and the folks couldn't come today, but they may be able to join us Thursday if we want to hear directly from them. If we're not that far along in the conversation, then they'll come when we get to some sort of bill that's ready to actually be discussed in detail. Right now, the bill that's there still has a blank line in the date, which has caused some concern, because depending on the way the line gets filled in on the date, it changes which counties are eligible. And that was not my intention. My intention was to have the counties that were already eligible back when we passed the bill originally remain the counties that are eligible, with the exception of the bill calls for Clatsop County to be added in as a site that would be added to the list. And I don't know exactly what the other things. I think it also doesn't say when these TDOs would sunset or whether they would sunset currently. I think there's a blank line there as well. That needs to get resolved. And then several provisions of the bill are under discussion. So, anyway, that's kind of confusing, but we're in discussion. I wanted to give you some update because we're still talking about it, and I didn't want you to be totally shocked when we come up with either yes, everybody's on board, or no, everybody's not, and here are the policy choices in front of us.
Chair Clem, yeah. Members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. All of that is what I was going to say. I think what I would like to add is that these transferable development opportunities that were created were part of a deal. That deal, one side of that deal has been done. The other side of the deal is the TDOs. They need to land somewhere. So we are committed to that. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
We're going to hold it over, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to carry it over. I don't know that if we don't have anything yet to report on Thursday, I'm going to drag him down here for just a repeat of the exact same thing I said, but that's the basic update for now, and I wanted to get at least one public hearing in before the deadline to schedule things about a status, because we haven't really talked about it this whole session. It's just been sitting there. Okay, and with that, I will close the public hearing, House Bill 3431.
Are you about to close the...
Yeah, anything for the good of the order.
Two quick things. One is, despite my original opposition to that bill we just discussed, it was a precursor to your incredible ability to bring people together and work out compromises. So I'm grateful for that experience and how you have continued to do that. And secondly, I don't know if anybody else noticed in the geology slides, what is the term for when they show it down to the stripped earth, starts with a T?
Topography?
No, it's a kind of...
The LIDAR pictures?
LIDAR, it starts with an L.
You're right. That's why I screwed you up.
We're on the same.
There was one that showed particularly dangerous areas, and there was pink, and then there was lavender. Was anybody else confused looking at the map and then seeing Chandler's lavender shirt as a really dangerous area? I just
pink shirt.
Just wondered.
Touché. Anything else for the good of the order?
And another thing.
I had to be somewhere.
I'm done.
I think we really need to, yeah. I'm just going to reschedule the Metolius one for when. I don't think we need to hear about it Thursday, and I'll save them some time. Yeah. Okay. So, well, maybe I will, just in case, and I'll take it off if we don't need it. So I'll carry over House Bill 3431. I don't have to reschedule. And with that, I'll adjourn the committee. And now that... And now that